Today is Monday, March 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the Russia investigation is over and the president is declaring he has been exonerated.
The president has not been exonerated by the special counsel, yet the attorney general has decided not to go further or apparently to share those findings with the public. We cannot simply rely on what may be a hasty, partisan interpretation of the facts.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a close ally of President Trump, will be visiting the White House this week. Also ahead, following last week's tragic massacre at a New Zealand mosque, thousands attend an anti-racism vigil in Christchurch. It's all on today's International Edition. Special Counsel Robert Mueller did not find evidence that President Trump's campaign conspired or coordinated with Russia to influence the 2016 presidential election, but reached no conclusion on whether Trump obstructed justice. Attorney General William Barr said on Sunday that brought a hearty claim of vindication from Trump, but set the stage for new rounds of political and legal fighting.
It was just announced there was no collusion with Russia, the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. There was no collusion with Russia. There was no obstruction and none whatsoever. And it was a complete and total exoneration. It's a shame that our country had to go through this. To be honest, it's a shame that your president has had to go through this before I even got elected. It began, and it began illegally, and hopefully somebody's going to look at the other side. This was an illegal takedown that failed.
But on the question of whether Trump tried to obstruct justice by interfering with or trying to derail the Mueller probe, the attorney general said it doesn't conclude the president obstructed justice in trying to undermine investigations into the election, but said there was no obstruction. Democrats promptly called for the release of Mueller's full report. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler said his panel will call the attorney general to testify in the near future in light of the very concerning discrepancies and final decision-making at the Justice Department following the special counsel report.
The special counsel spent 22 months uncovering evidence of obstruction and other misconduct. Attorney General Barr, who auditioned for his role with an open memorandum suggesting that the obstruction investigation was unconscionable and that a president and that it was almost impossible for any president to commit obstruction of justice since he is the head of the executive branch, made a decision about that evidence in under 48 hours. His conclusions raise more questions than the answer.
And Nadler added that Barr had long ago decided about the issue of obstruction of justice, as noted in a long memo he had sent to the Justice Department, is what Nadler is referring to, long before he took the job as Attorney General.
He auditioned for his job by writing a 19-page memorandum giving a very extreme view of obstruction of justice and of presidential power and saying basically that no president could really commit obstruction of justice.
Well, joining us now to get further analysis on what we know so far is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, why would the issue of obstruction not be given any conclusion, given that many analysts had indicated it seemed to be in plain sight?
It's always difficult to look at the tea leaves after the fact and try to figure out exactly why it is that this investigation came out that it did. And if you look at some of the decisions that the president made, I mean, you can go directly to his own words when he was talking to MSNBC and he said he fired Comey because of Russia. Mm-hmm. And that in itself feels like obstruction. What we find is that the attorney general essentially said this was insufficient for the obstruction charge itself. The problem, of course, and I think this is one of the things that the Democrats will be looking at, the attorney general was somewhat biased in the first place. His own previous editorials mm-hmm. on this issue seemed to show that he was leaning for the president strongly mm-hmm. and against the Mueller investigation in the first place.
Right.
So the idea that he would be independent, I think, is unrealistic.
Do you think that that played a role in why, when it was left up to him, he decided that there is no cause for charging the president with any sort of obstruction?
That's a difficult call, but I suspect that is exactly what you're going to see from the Democrats in this
mm-hmm.
case. And I think there's something to it. There is a viable argument to be made here that the fact that Bob Mueller decided not to find obstruction, and then leaving it to Barr, who inevitably went the direction it feels like he wanted to always go, is going to be the grit that the Democrats will use in the coming months. I think that Congress has the obligation to investigate an issue if they feel they have a justification to do so. The fact that it is an open question tells me that they do have the determination. Congress does not have to depend upon the opinion of a Republican attorney general to decide what they will or will not do. They have the right to fulfill their constitutional obligation, and at least at this point, the House seems to be going down that path.
Do you think, though, that Congress will have a harder time making the case for all the investigations they're doing, given these results?
The results of the Russia investigation that have come out will make it harder for Congress to continue to do their own investigation, simply because you will now see, not surprisingly, the Republicans holding this report up as gospel in the way that they were trying to burn it two days ago. And that this in itself says that Congress should not be investigating this. And in fact, this says that the president was innocent.
The president has already come out saying that he's totally exonerated, no collusion, no obstruction. The Mueller report didn't quite go that far, even if Barr did decide there was no obstruction. My understanding of the Mueller report said that there was no conclusion on that. It did not exonerate Trump of obstruction. It did not charge him or exonerate him. What does that mean?
The president wasn't exonerated in this case. It dealt with the question of the conspiracy between the president and the Russians. What was left open is the question of obstruction. That has not been determined at this point, other than the opinion of the attorney general. That's not the end of the story. So addressing that question, this was not a full exoneration. As to the question of whether this was a witch hunt, the president claims that this report proves that it was. This was not a witch hunt. Just because Bob Mueller decided the way that he did didn't mean he didn't have the right, the authority, or really the desire to come to what the truth actually meant and what the evidence actually showed. Based upon those conclusions, it doesn't mean that it was inappropriate to look at it in the first place. In fact, it absolutely was appropriate when you consider the number of people who were indicted, the number of people who were convicted, and the legitimacy of the Constitution in the first place. The fact that this president decided he wants to call it a witch hunt because he doesn't like his name attached to it, I think that in itself is something that we're going to have to struggle with as we look at this next week, next month, but in the decades to come.
Just because a crime cannot be proven, does that mean there was no crime?
Just because you can't prove a crime doesn't mean that a crime didn't occur. In this case, we will see if the investigations are over. Congress is now looking at this, and they will dig a little deeper. They may look beyond what the Russia investigation was looking at in the first place, and we will see where this goes. In the end, what I think is critically important is that there is transparency for the American people. Transparency when it comes to the Bob Mueller report, much as possible, and as much transparency that we're seeing from Congress to make sure that the American people can look at, can understand, and believe the results of that investigation as well.
All right, that's criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Israel strikes Gaza after border bombs. Syrian fighters are clearing explosives in an area retaken from ISIS. A cloud lifts over Trump, but at a cost. And the Taliban is said to have killed 65 Afghan forces. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump this week in Washington. The meeting comes as Netanyahu's Likud party is lagging in opinion polls ahead of elections next month. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his chief rival, former Chief of Staff Benny Gantz, are both speaking at the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee meeting this week in Washington. But only Netanyahu is scheduled to meet with President Donald Trump and attend a state dinner at the White House. Trump announced a change in American policy on the Golan Heights, which Israel seized from Syria in 1967 and later annexed. Trump tweeted last week that the United States recognizes Israeli sovereignty over the territory and later explained the move in an interview with Fox News Business. He compared it to his decision last year to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
I was inundated with calls from all over the world, the leaders, mostly the leaders, saying, please don't do it, don't do it. I did it, and it's been done, and it's fine. Golan Heights is the same thing. This is sovereignty. This is security. This is about regional security.
It's not about Netanyahu's reelection.
No, I wouldn't even know about that.
Netanyahu is facing a series of corruption allegations, and the latest opinion polls show the new blue and white party headed by Gantz edging past Netanyahu's Likud. The Israeli prime minister has stressed his close relationship with Trump, and he lauded close U.S.-Israeli ties in a meeting with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo last week.
Our alliance in recent years has never been stronger. It's an unbreakable bond that's based on shared values of liberty and democracy and shared interests to fight the enemies of democracy, the enemies of our way of life, the terrorists that prowl our airspace and prowl our countries. And I think that working together, we've been able to achieve an enormous amount.
Netanyahu also thanked the United States for walking away from what he called the disastrous Iran nuclear deal. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Viking Ocean Cruises says all the passengers and crew of its Viking Sky are safe and that the ship has docked in Norway after it had to be rescued. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The cruise ship made it to shore Sunday, accompanied by tugboats. The day before, passenger Alexis Shepard from California shared video online of what happened when they hit rough seas and issued a mayday after engine trouble. Chairs and other furniture went flying across the floor, and part of the ceiling came down.
I'm a yachtswoman. I've spent a lot of time on yachts, and this was unlike anything that I've ever experienced before. So, yes, it was absolutely horrible.
I'm Julie Walker.
Thais voted Sunday in an election called a return to democratic rule, but which was widely criticized, or has been widely criticized, as an exercise designed by Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-ha to entrench his military's stranglehold on power. As Steve Sanford reports from Bangkok, initial reports indicate, or results indicate, the military-backed party is in the lead.
Thai voters turned out in record numbers amid tight security in the country's first election since the 2014 military coup that brought junta leader Prayut Chan-o-cha to power. The mood appeared jubilant at times as the long-awaited moment arrived.
I see a movement of youngsters coming in, hoping to make a change, but I think it'll be a while before we see that change, but it's a good start.
After today, I think everything is getting better. The new election can make the economy getting better.
Election monitors from 11 countries observed polling stations amid reports of vote buying and other irregularities. But critics say that the day of truth will come on May 9, when official final results will be announced.
Everything will become clearer as to the junta and General Prayut will be successful in their bid to hold on to power using this election as their springboard, or the voices of Thai people who want to see change, who want to step out of repressive military rule towards democratic civilian rule, whether that dream will come true or not.
Meanwhile, supporters of the Pheu Party of ousted former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra braced for a rough road ahead, as early results showed the army-linked Palong Pracharat Party in the lead. Thais will be waiting anxiously to see what real changes will come with the election results. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Bangkok, Thailand.
Well, the Venezuelan government in Caracas, under the control of President Nicolas Maduro, has denounced as illegal the takeover this week of some of its diplomatic offices in the United States by representatives of opposition leader Juan Guaido, who declared himself interim leader of the oil-rich but economically impoverished nation. But as VOA's Brian Patton reports, the move by the U.S. to legitimize Guaido and further isolate the embattled Maduro government has recent legal precedent and could give the opposition a legitimate platform to authorize economic aid or even call for military intervention.
Representatives from the Venezuelan opposition-led government of Juan Guaido encountered little resistance when they recently took over two buildings belonging to Venezuela's defense ministry in Washington and one consular building in New York City.
In this building, it had been occupied in an illegal manner by officials from the regime of Nicolas Maduro.
President Nicolas Maduro had already recalled all 55 Venezuelan diplomats in the U.S., but 12 opted to stay behind and support Guaido, the head of the country's National Assembly, who declared himself interim president after Maduro blocked opponents from running in last year's election. Washington withdrew its diplomats from Caracas, preventing any potential for retaliation against U.S. officials. But Maduro's security forces this week apprehended Guaido's chief of staff, Roberto Marrero. Venezuela's foreign ministry denounced the takeover as a violation of international law. However, the Guaido government has been legally recognized by the U.S. and most Western countries. And there is recent historical precedent. In 2011, President Barack Obama transferred control of Libyan diplomatic assets in the U.S. to the Transitional National Council to support its efforts to oust leader Muammar Gaddafi. Gaddafi was later killed by opposition forces supported by the U.S. The Venezuelan embassy has not yet been taken over by the opposition. The delay may be because the U.S. is trying to resolve possible legal disputes with a third country acting on behalf of the Maduro government.
In all likelihood, there is a protecting power, meaning another state that Venezuela has entrusted its property and control of them to as kind of a stewardship. And the United States may be negotiating with that power to facilitate this transfer.
With control of U.S. diplomatic offices, the opposition will have a more legitimate platform to authorize aid shipments that so far have been blocked by Maduro's security forces, or even to call for military intervention to oust Maduro.
Another very controversial possibility, but is a possibility, is that the United States or some other government will look to the Guaido government to authorize a military intervention and say, we want the United States to come into Venezuela and help us reestablish control over our state, which lawfully we are entitled to.
Even though Maduro remains in power in Caracas, the opposition will now speak on behalf of Venezuela in the U.S. and could soon seek to represent their country at the United Nations and other international forums. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
Thousands of people attended a vigil in Christchurch, New Zealand, Sunday to protest racism and to remember the 50 Muslims who were killed in two mosques last week by a white nationalist. Many of the women in attendance continued making and wearing headscarves in solidarity with their Muslim neighbors. Arash Arbasadi reports.
Volunteers come together Sunday, sewing headscarves at a community center in Christchurch, New Zealand.
Well, personally, I love sewing, and this is a way that I can contribute, doing something that I enjoy. And no, I have no problem at all with, I was wearing a headscarf myself earlier on, and no, I'm fine with anybody that to show their face.
Libby Davis lives in Christchurch. There, a gunman opened fire during Friday prayers at two mosques on March 15th, killing 50 people. A week later, the greater community mourned the victims. Since then, women in Christchurch donned headscarves in support of the Muslim community.
We just want to let them know that we're there for them, and we've heard that some Muslims haven't felt safe going out in their headscarves, and we want to show them that it's still a safe community even though the terror attack has happened.
The vigil comes just 2 days after the first Friday prayers since the massacre.
I loved it. Like, on Friday, I went to the Friday prayer, and I couldn't tell who was Muslim, who wasn't, and it was really heartwarming. And then my professor also wore the hijab, and a few classmates of mine wore the hijab, too, and it's, like, really awesome to see. I definitely support it.
Thousands attended Sunday's vigil in Christchurch. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has called the shooting a terror attack and announced changes to the country's gun laws with support from the head of New Zealand's police association. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. At the 27th Annual Environmental Film Festival in the nation's capital, over 100 films were showcased in 25 locations around the city. Many of them focused on the human impact on climate change worldwide, pointing to severe weather phenomena already underway, such as rising sea levels and disappearing biodiversity. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with filmmakers who came to D.C. to present their work.
Humans go from being participants in the whole Earth to being a dominant feature.
The documentary Anthropocene shows the impact of humans on the planet. Anthropocene was one of 100 films showcased at the 27th Annual Environmental Film Festival in the nation's capital.
It is such a fundamental change in the way the Earth is behaving that we need to communicate that as powerfully as possible to everybody.
Similarly, Welcome to Sodom documents the world's largest electronic waste dump in Ghana. Hundreds of thousands of electronic equipment gets dismantled by children and adolescents in toxic smoke. In Sharkwater Extinction, the late filmmaker Rob Stewart shows how illegal fishing practices threaten the survival of sharks.
We're killing up to 150 million sharks a year.
Sharks are now renamed and fed to us. Pet food, livestock feed, and even in cosmetics.
We depend on other species for survival. Removing sharks is removing part of the framework that allows life to exist on land.
In Groundwork, Canadian filmmaker Andrew Nisker raises questions about the health impact of chemicals used to maintain green, weed-free golf courses, lawns, and playgrounds. Nisker told VOA how his documentary evolved as he was seeking answers on the causes of his father's cancer. His father was an avid golf player who died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Glyphosate, Roundup is one of those brand names of the chemical.
He said so far, two plaintiffs with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma have won multi-million dollar rulings against the manufacturer of weed killer Roundup.
People are waking up to the fact that what is being put on lawns and parks and gardens are not benign.
In The River and the Wall, filmmaker Ben Masters treks 1,200 miles by the Rio Grande along the U.S.-Mexico border to examine what impact a contiguous border wall would have on the environment and the local ranchers.
Is the border on the river, or is the border at the wall?
Without the water, we can't operate.
We need strong borders. We have to stop drugs and crime and criminals and human trafficking, and we have to stop all of those things that a strong wall will stop.
Masters told VOA a contiguous wall along the Rio Grande River, and especially in the lower Rio Grande Valley, would cut the water supply of many animal species trapped on the one side and would change the area's ecological makeup.
They're building it through some national wildlife refuges and a bunch of really important habitat in this area that's this major conduit of migratory flyways for songbirds, bats, and butterflies. So at a localized level, there's some pretty substantial habitat loss from the enforcement zone.
As the fire season nears, Alex Jablonski's documentary Wildland hits home, chronicling the grueling training of wildland firefighters and their bonding during the long hours of hauling equipment and hiking ridgelines to fight fires. Jablonski had to train and get a firefighter's license with the rest of the group in order to shoot the documentary.
You hear about the fires, but you don't necessarily hear about the firefighters until someone dies.
And so I was really interested in the idea of like, well, what are these guys really like? And can we tell a story where if you hear about a fire on the news, if you see, you know, wildfire footage, you actually stop for a moment and think about the people who are actually fighting them.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Singer-songwriter and activist Cyndi Lauper will be bringing some serious star power to some lucky college graduates. She'll be giving the commencement speech at Northern Vermont University Johnson in May. Lauper, who is now 65, graduated from the school, or went to the school, which was formerly known as Johnson State College back in the 1970s. While she didn't graduate and earn a degree, Lauper did go on to become a very successful musician, earning more than a dozen Grammy nominations and winning two of them. She also produced lots of hits like Girls Just Want to Have Fun, Time After Time, and True Colors. Lauper, who has been an advocate in the LGBT community, will be awarded an honorary doctorate. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.